Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also chemtrailed and Fukushima irradiated, which is great for the economy because everybody now has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is Randall Carlson from sacredgeometryinternational.info. Randall, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Vinny.
Now, just glancing at your website, you appear to be quite the prestigious SOB.
Yeah, I have pretensions of being such.
Pretensions of being prestigious. This is going to be a great interview.
Well, given my blue-collar working-class background, it's most definitely pretense on my part.
All right. Well, let's get into it then. Could you explain just a little bit about how you got into Sacred Geometry? And more to the point, why you started Sacred Geometry International?
First, I'll take your first question, how I got into it. I would say it went back to the late 60s and early 70s. It seemed like a lot of things trace their genesis back to those days. But it seemed that under certain conditions, certain states of mind, the geometry of the universe seemed to be quite prevalent. And once those days sort of evolved past those days, I became a builder. I followed in the footsteps of my father, and I got interested in form and structure. And in looking into the history of the craft that I was attempting to learn, I kept stumbling upon interesting coincidences and interesting tidbits of information about how they used to do things in the old days. And I think, a pivotal point came in the summer of 72 when I was involved with a spiritual group, and we were building a couple of Buckminster Fuller domes up in the Northwoods of Minnesota. And one of them had been designed by an architect to mimic certain geometric patterns in Islamic mosque design. And since myself and a couple of my younger brothers that were involved in the group were the only ones who had carpentry and building experience, since our father was in that profession, we got drafted to sort of be the head carpenters on the project. So we built these two geodesic domes, and that got me very interested in the whole subject of alternate building, alternate design, and kind of led me into a study of the history of architecture. Then when the next year a publication came out that featured one of those two domes, we referred to it as the Bindu Dome, and it was a national publication called Shelter. that has actually recently been re-released, and it had a full page spread on this particular project, but scattered throughout the book were references to things that were at that time unfamiliar to me. The idea of the divine proportion used in medieval architecture, more information on the geometry used by the Islamic builders in their mosques, in their calligraphy, in their rug weaving, and so on. And I think at that point it kind of led me into an interest in, well, what's going on here? You know, I never heard about any of this, you know, going to school. I never heard that there was, you know, principles used universally by these ancient cultures. So I started into a in-depth research, and pretty much it's been ongoing to this day. Led me into a few years later, in the late 70s, I entered the Masonic craft, because they're kept turning up in my researches over and over again. So it began to appear to me that they must have some handle on some kind of information. So out of curiosity, I went into the craft. I've been an active member ever since. And I did find that, yeah, there's a whole repository of information there, although it's usually not accessed by your run-of-the-mill brother. It's pretty much esoteric only because it's, you know, pretty much being neglected. And that's kind of how I got into the sacred geometry thing. I think I did my first ever presentation on the subject in 1980 to a group of people. And, of course, in 1980, no one really had ever heard of it. And I didn't even call it sacred geometry then. But I've been off and on ever since. I've been doing courses, classes, lectures, multimedia presentations. And, of course, since then, there's been a tremendous increase in the interest in the subject. So I'm finding myself suddenly being looked upon as being, you know, the go-to man, although I feel like really my studies of it are only scratching the surface, because it's a vast, vast subject that has many applications. So I've been interested, obviously, in the architectural applications, but I quickly discovered as I learned more that it involved many other avenues of interest, you know, particularly in nature, in biology, in geology, in astronomy. So I found, and then the thing that I've kind of has led me into another aspect of it is, we always think of geometry as being a way of describing or measuring space and spatial relationships. As I begin to work through the various principles and the forms and patterns of sacred geometry, one of the things that seemed to recur over and over again was this canon of numbers that somehow seemed to be intrinsic to astronomical measurements, architectural measurements, the ancient systems of metrology or measurement that were used throughout the ancient world, from Cambodia to ancient British Isles to Mesoamerican, Central America, to Egypt. And so there seemed to be a consistent system of metrology or measurement used by many of these ancient cultures that all seemed to be derived from a common geometric pattern. And associated with that were a series of recurrent numbers, which I would call the canon of sacred numerology or sacred numbers, that we find over and over again embedded in natural processes and in ancient art and architecture. And so one of the most interesting applications I found of these numbers was when I began to look into change over long-term periods of time, geological change and historical change, it soon became evident to me that there were patterns of change as well. It wasn't just a smooth linear progression, but there were definitely episodes of concentrated change. Nodal points, if you will, points of discontinuity within the historical record, within the geological record. And those points of discontinuity seem to have an apparent tempo or rhythm to them. And the tempo could be measured by these same exact numbers. And so we find the precessional cycle, which is the Earth's third motion, for example, precession of the equinoxes, has a periodicity of about 26,000 years. Well, there was a sacred number used to measure that. Comes right out, straight out of the Vedas and other ancient traditions, of 25,920. And when you divide that up, you know, this is the model of the great year, which the ancients was, that was their concept of the larger framework of time. Within the great year, just as there is in our annual year, there were 12 months, or our 12 months, there were 12 months in the great year, and this is what we've kind of come through pop culture to know as the ages of the world, you know, the age of Aries, followed by the age of Pisces, followed by the age of Aquarius. Well, within that cycle of 26,000 years, there are 12 of these, and they work out to be an average of 2,160 years each. Well, that was a number that was familiar to me from geometry, because one of the five regular Platonic solids, the cube or the hexahedron, is exactly measured by 2,160 degrees. And then further, when you measure the diameter of the moon, it's 2,160 miles. And so this is just an example of how these redundant relationships described by the same number. And we can go through, and there's a whole, I call them a canon, of these sacred numbers that recur over and over again. What the ultimate meaning of it is, I'm not exactly sure yet, other than it seems to be a correlation between space and time expressed through these fundamental geometric relationships, which perhaps gives us a means whereby we can have some sense or measure of predictability if we know, in other words, the pattern of the past, the pattern within the smooth flow of time when these discontinuities have occurred, and we know that tempo. We can potentially then have a sense of predictability about when could we expect such points of concentrated change to occur again.
Are you talking about a geometric kind of pattern for, like, prophecy?
Yeah, I would suggest that. Not prophecy as some kind of supernatural phenomena, but prophecy more like this. You know, here in the Northern Hemisphere, every week it's getting a little warmer because it's springtime. Down in New Zealand, you're having, I'll say down under. I don't mean that you're down on a lower status by any means because you're in New Zealand, but you're obviously going into fall time. Well, you know that you have a measure of predictability that it's going to be likely that a month from now, 2 months from now, your average temperature is going to be considerably lower than it is right now, right? Nothing supernatural about that. It's just, you're familiar with the cyclical change, and you know the nature of the regularity of the cyclical change. Well, I think what we're talking about here is that there's a larger framework, a larger model of understanding how the world works that suggests that there are temporal changes that occur on a broader scale. So if we know, for example, the quote-unquote season of the great year or the month of the great year, it may give us a sense of predictability. For example, we know that the planet frequently shifts back and forth between glacial and interglacial ages. There's no ambiguity about that anymore. It's well established. You know, that up here in North America, if you look at a map of North America, you'll see that there are no glaciers, permanent glaciers, other than mountain glaciers, anywhere in North America to speak of. However, if we go back 13, 14, 15,000 years ago, about two-thirds of North America was buried under a mile to two-mile thick ice sheet. Well, that's a pretty dramatic change, shifting from that glacial age into the age that we're in now. And if we go back through time, we discover that there has been the entire Pleistocene, roughly the last 2.6 million years, has been characterized by this swinging oscillation of global climate between glacial and interglacial ages. Nobody really has an explanation for that yet. You know, there's as many different researchers and scientists have looked at it, there's that many different explanations. I think where they've fallen down is that they've basically tried to invoke purely terrestrial mechanisms to account for these dramatic swings in global climate, whereas I think the source is actually extraterrestrial, personally. But in a sense, this is the same way. If we know that, for example, that the longest interglacial period of the last quarter million years has been 10,000 years, and that we're now currently in an interglacial that's 10,000 years old, well, there may be some sense that maybe within the next millennium or two or century or two, we could expect a shift. So again, nothing supernatural about it.
Okay, so it's simple like that. It's just to do with measurements and time and the effects of planetary bodies and things like that, which is pretty straightforward, you know. But here's the question. How did the ancient peoples know all about this? Did they have modern measurement devices, timekeeping pieces, things of that nature that we've got today?
Well, yeah, I think, Vinny, you've honed in on the fundamental question, and that's the question that I don't think has been resolved yet. It's one of those things where, as the years go by, we begin to learn more and more about the capabilities and the understanding of these ancient cultures. More and more, we're impressed by the sophistication of their knowledge and their scientific knowledge. Now, that doesn't necessarily imply that they had a technological society similar to our own. But you got to bear in mind now, we're looking, our species is probably 250,000 years old. Now, we've pushed back the age of skeletal discoveries of modern humans to between 150,000 and 180,000 years. Now, we're talking about modern skeletons. If you look at their physiognomy, you look at their anatomy, you look at their cranial capacity, they seem to be every bit the equal of ourselves. Okay, now you got to think about this. Let's just take conservatively 150,000 years that we modern humans have been walking around on this planet, but our history is only, recorded history is only 5,000 years old. So, you know, we're looking at a 20th or a 30th of the time that we humans have been on the planet do we actually have a record of. So now, you know, you can get into kind of the woo-woo factor here and speculate that, you know, there were these advanced civilizations in the past, and of course, all kinds of cultural traditions would suggest such things, whether we're talking about, you know, the fall from paradise or Atlantis or Hyperborea or any number of these myths about a former, you know, the golden age. Whether we take those literally or not, there is a whole corpus of mythical belief about a former order of things that somehow came to an end through whatever means. Now, when we couple that together with the idea that there have been enormous changes that have occurred to this planet throughout the time that we humans have been here. I'm talking about just extreme changes, dramatic changes. You know, the old sort of the orthodoxy is that, you know, there's been this smooth continuum from, you know, tens of thousands of years of barbarism up into the pinnacle of modern civilization, which now represents, you know, the epitome of whatever humans have accomplished on this planet.
Unfortunately, we're coming to break, but what I find the irony is that although time's moving forward, humanity seems to be in a lot of ways moving very, very quickly backwards.
I agree with that, Vinny.
Yeah. And all we'll right. be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Randall Carlson from sacredgeometryinternational.info. There's an awful lot of videos there, documentaries, and even classes that you can take, ladies and gentlemen. So that's sacredgeometryinternational.info. Back in a minute.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed our status of God. Our needs are now different, and our aims. The conditions which frame and taught us our status of God. The world we knew is gone.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. You can listen in live on the homepage at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Also, the archives to our radio programs, my radio programs, American Freedom Radio's radio programs. Man, I'm going to say, how many radio programs can I mention in a sentence? At thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and americanfreedomradio.com, there are archive sections aplenty, and I advise you to check them out. Usually when we have a guest on a webcam on this broadcast, I try to make my guests cackle a little bit. You know, just a little bit of cackling. It makes the world go round, I reckon. A few laughs while we're talking about how we're getting exterminated and enslaved by ruthless criminal sociopathic scumbags, you know. I reckon that's a good idea. So take a little snapshot of the person whilst in the middle of a righteous cackle, and that becomes the little picture of them for the podcast. And I think that if you go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com/2013, www.vineyeast.html. You can just scroll down and just have a look at the vast, massive array of guests that we have had on this show, all of which seem to be enjoying themselves. And if you like this format, it's very, very difficult to get any sort of income, sponsorship, things of that nature with this particular approach. So if you can, please do go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com homepage and donate either through the PayPal or the bank account number that's there, preferably setting up an automatic payment through the subscription button that is there too. You can get commercial-free archives that for $1 a month or $5 a month or $10 or $20, however much you feel, just so that we can keep everything running. Keep all these wonderful guests coming to you day by day, giving you incredible, intense, fabulous, life-changing information without actually charging anybody anything. It's all about, I'll give you whatever you want, and if you want to give me something back, please do. And I very much appreciate all the support that we've received at the Vinnie Eastwood Show so far. Coming up on 3 years of broadcasting. Not bad for a little young kid from New Zealand, I think. My very special guest is Randall Carver from sacredgeometryinternational.info. Randall, welcome back. Now, the element that we were talking about was how exactly the ancients knew about all of these different rafts of time and geometry and various other elements. What I found very interesting about the pyramids is that they're made of stone, and pyramids produce this really interesting energy. Like they've done this pyramid experiment in Russia where they've created a plastic pyramid, and they've put like a milliliter of water in there, and then they've given that milliliter of water to kids who are sick or something, and suddenly they get better. And various other miraculous things. And they've never been able to accomplish that with a steel or metal structure for some reason. You can't do it with metallics. And the pyramids are made of stone. And I thought that was very interesting. How did they know that?
Well, I'm not familiar with that work, Vinny. And I've never heard of using plastic. So this is something new now that I'm going to have to check out.
David Wilcock been talking about it. I think he came on a tour here to New Zealand. That was one of the parts of his presentation which I found intensely interesting. Uh-huh. But if it's not one of the elements of your experience, then,
I've certainly been interested in the pyramids from a geometric standpoint and from an architectural standpoint and an engineering standpoint. My one take on the Great Pyramid particularly, because I've examined the geometry of it inside and out, is that it manifests a very unique geometric relationship between a circle and a square, in that if you take the height of the pyramid, and this would be a pyramid reconstructed using the angle of slope to base measured from the existing still existing casing stones of 51 degrees 51 minutes, give or take a minute or two of arc. If you take the height of the pyramid, which would be just at 482 feet, and draw a circle using that as the radius, then that circumference of that circle will be precisely the same as the perimeter of this pyramid's square base. So it provides a solution to one of the classical problems of geometry, which was the squaring of the circle, the attempt to draw square and circle of equal perimeter using only the implements of classical geometry, which was a compass and an unmarked straight edge, because it was believed if you could create a geometric form with a compass and an unmarked straight edge, you could duplicate that process on a building site by using a sharpened pole stuck in the ground and using a straight line, either as a fixed line or as the radius of a circle with which you could draw arcs. There's a lot more going on with the pyramid than that, but that in terms of its geometry, is an interesting relationship. Also, it just so happens that if you take the angle of the pyramid's apothem, which is the measurement from the center of the pyramid's base up to its apex, and place that over the half the base, it's the golden section, the famous golden section, which is roughly 1.618 also the limit of what's known as the Fibonacci series or Fibonacci sequence. So there's a lot of interesting things going on geometrically there. And then geodetically, it's interesting too, because and this is very difficult to explain over you know, without graphics and visuals. And I go extensively into this in my DVD, actually, where we've got some very cool animations and graphics to show how the Great Pyramid of Khufu was a model of the Northern Hemisphere. Actually, it could be a model of the Southern Hemisphere, but it encodes within it very precise and sophisticated geodetic information, which is demonstrable to a point, I think, beyond any pale of coincidence. But again, it would be very difficult to explain without reliance on the visuals that I use to explain it. But you have to understand that the Earth spinning on its axis is not a perfect sphere. You understood that, right? You know that the equatorial diameter is larger than the polar diameter because as it spins on its axis, the mass, the plastic mass of the Earth migrates towards the equator. And so the equatorial diameter of the Earth is 26 miles greater than the polar diameter. And this equatorial bulge, it's a good thing that it's there because it helps to keep the Earth stable in its orbit. Without that equatorial bulge, the Earth would be free to be much more chaotic in its orbital motions.
Well, there's a part of the sea level there, I believe, along the equator is on average about 500 meters or so larger than, say, the sea level in London.
It is. I don't think it's that much. But it is definitely, yeah, but for the same reason, because the fluid oceans are migrate towards the equator because of that centrifugal throw caused by the Earth spinning on its axis, the same way that the plastic mass of the Earth does. But what that means is that when you measure, for example, a square degree of latitude and longitude, let's say at the equator, there's going to be a difference between those two. And if you take them and you look at that difference, that difference is actually encoded into the geometry of the pyramid. And again, I guess the best I can do is, since we don't have visuals for a radio broadcast, I have extensive visuals and graphics in the DVD to show exactly how this was accomplished. But that brings us back to your question again. I also mentioned that the video of that, I've just been informed, is available on the website. So if somebody goes to the website, sacredgeometryinternational.com, there should be a video describing or showing what I've just been attempting to describe. But it does bring us back to the issue, the question you asked earlier is how would ancient peoples have known some of this? In other words, assuming that this isn't just some ridiculous, unsubstantial claim that I'm making, that the Great Pyramid encodes the very precise geodetic information about the size and shape of the Earth, assuming that's not just some woo-woo claim, then it does, of course, raise the question of how would somebody have known that. And one of the things that I do in the DVD presentation is I basically show all of the geodetic surveys that have been done actually going back to the 1800s, coming right down to our satellite surveys, to show how the accuracy of the dimensions of the Earth has improved with our ability to utilize satellites. Anyways, when we talk about the pyramid, if we were to basically enlarge the pyramid by a scaling factor of 43,200, and this is getting back to one of those sacred numbers that I was talking about earlier, 43,200. Half of that is 21,600. Remember I mentioned the number 2,160? Remember earlier in the first segment I talked about the diameter of the moon, the angular measure of a hexahedron, the number of years in a month or a platonic epoch of the great year. 21,600, if we raise that number by a power of 10, we have 21,600. That's basically the number of minutes of arc in the circumference of the Earth, and it's also the number of nautical miles in the measure of the Earth. If we double that number, we get 43,200. Now, if we take the present Great Pyramid of Khufu, enlarge it by precisely 43,200 times, scale it up, its square base is going to be exactly then equivalent to the round circumference of the Earth's equator. And that's the scaling factor, 43,200. The height of the pyramid, right at 481 point something feet, times 43,200 will be the Earth's polar radius. So it's this remarkable coincidence that, again, it's best understood seeing the visuals, the graphics of it, which you can see actually on the website if you go there. We have an extensive dissertation about that because it's in the DVD. Well, again, so that brings us back to this question, assuming that I'm not full of it here, and that they really did accomplish this, how did they know that? And that was the question you posed just before the break. How would they have had access to this information? And what I was then describing was the fact that, you know, we humans, with presumably equivalent intelligence to our own modern, you know, scientific, highly technologically advanced humans, we have no reason to believe that the people of 50,000 years ago would have been any less intelligent based upon, you know, the size of their cranial capacity and so forth. So the question then becomes is why did it take so long for us to emerge from barbarism, from so many tens of thousands of years of a hunter-gatherer existence into actually figuring out things like how to write, how to build cities, you know, how to keep a record of things? And, you know, that's a fair question. And I think sort of historical orthodoxy has assumed that previous to recorded history, we basically had, you know, we went from the Bronze Age back to the Neolithic or New Stone Age, from the Neolithic to the Mesolithic, which was the Middle Stone Age, and then, you know, the Neolithic lasted a couple thousand years, the Mesolithic lasted a few thousand years, then we get into the Paleolithic, and the Paleolithic is lasting for tens of thousands of years, in other words, the Old Stone Age. Well, see, I think it's fair to call that whole model into question. And when we think about, you know, think about, Vinny, how much we've presumably progressed, at least in a technological sense, in the last, say, 300 years, since the time of the Renaissance or since the time of the scientific enlightenment. How far we've progressed just since the dawn of the 20th century. You know, when my grandfather never tired of telling me, you know, when I was a kid growing up, well, there was no airplanes when I was a kid and no automobiles, you know, just like now I'm telling kids, well, nobody had personal computers or cell phones when I was a kid. There was no internet, you know. When you just begin to think about how far we progressed just in a century, well, let's assume that some global catastrophe comes along and eliminates our advanced society, and we have to start all over again with a Stone Age existence. 10,000 years from now, how much record would there be of our little experiment in advanced industrial, technological, scientific civilization? You know, it could, a few centuries could easily get swallowed up and disappear. And so when we consider the fact that there was 100,000 or 150,000 years of human history that of which there is no record, my point is that who knows what heights of evolutionary, you know, social evolutionary development we could have obtained during that interval. Then the question that raises is, well, why is there no record? And, of course, what I would say to that is simply this, that it's only in the last 2 to 3 to 4 decades that we've come to understand how truly catastrophic the history of this planet has been. Not over just over the long term of millions of years, but also over the much shorter term of a few thousand to a few tens of thousands of years. And if you think human beings, let's say we've been around 150, modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, been around 150, 180,000 years, well, we've had at least 4 to 6 full-blown glacial ages that have come and gone in that period of time. Now, you think about a glacial age coming on, what happens? 6 to 7 million cubic square miles of the Earth's surface is swallowed up under perennially frozen glacial ice. Sea level drops by 400 feet worldwide. There are enormous climatic changes and environmental changes as a consequence of that.
Right, well, we're coming to break now, and I would like to indeed go over this abrupt kind of climate shift that we're talking about in the glacial movements when we come back, ladies and gentlemen, with Randall Carver from sacredgeometryinternational.info. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I'm here with Randall Carlson, which means son of Carl, apparently. I haven't double-checked that fact. Welcome back, Randall.
Well, I'm glad to be back. Where was I?
Yeah.
I went out to tell the guy operating a router to shut up.
Operating a router? Like, he was router. I presume it's not an Ethernet router.
No, this is the old, we're the woodworking router. We're restoring a canoe.
Restoring a canoe? Yes. You know what's interesting? As that was happening, I was thinking about an old joke that I made up. The Māori word for food is kai, and I thought about making a Māori food TV show called Kai Yakking.
Oh, yeah?
And incidentally, you're in the background working on a canoe while I'm thinking about kayaking.
Yes. Well, of course, this had two paddlers in it, not a single. This was tandem. It's a racing canoe. That was something I did back in the old days, in my youth. Being from Minnesota, I don't know if you know Minnesota. Minnesota is a state we have here in the U.S.
Is that a place where all the sodas are really small?
Yeah, well, you could look at it that way. It's most well known for its many, many lakes, 15,000 lakes, because, well, getting back to this whole question we were talking about earlier with glacial and interglacial ages, most of Minnesota was buried under glacial ice, and the 15,000 lakes are the puddles left over from the melting away of the great mass of glacial ice. So I mostly grew up on the shores of one of these little glacial lakes. And that actually is one of the reasons I sort of got interested in things like ice ages in the first place, knowing that where I had lived was had once been under thousands of feet of ice. Not so long ago, actually. So.
Right, and how does that actually relate to geometry and things of that nature? Because there was the other element here, too, where you're studying sacred geometry, you know, sacredgeometryinternational.info, obviously. And I saw that there was a section on there on geology. How does geometry relate to geology?
Well, what's the common factor there between geometry and geology? The earth, right? One is the science of the earth and the other is the measurement of the earth. So ultimately, there must be some kind of a connection there, etymologically speaking, right? Mm. Well, it gets back to what I was saying in in the first discussion we were having about the canon of sacred numbers. Again, it's because when I start looking at these numbers related to geometric forms, I find these numbers that are also embedded in the geological record, curiously enough. And a geological record, you might think of as being a record of temporal changes through time. And one of the important insights here is that basically there are two modes of global change. The mode that we're in now, which is basically uniform, gradualistic, you know, it's pretty predictable. You know, we expect that when you get up in the morning, the sun's going to be rising. You can expect the seasons to change. You know, you expect winter is going to be followed by a thawing of spring, and you expect that the heat of summer is going to be followed by the cooling of autumn and so forth. And this is all quite predictable. Well, bear in mind now that when you are talking about the onset of a glacial age, all that predictability goes out the window. And it's not too much of an exaggeration to describe the onset of a glacial age like this. Imagine that, you know, at least, again, I'll reference because I'm coming from the northern hemisphere, but I imagine you get snowfall. Are you on the South or North Island?
I'm on the North Island. I will never go back living in the South Island. When I was a student, I watched my olive oil freeze at room temperature. That was enough.
Okay, this is what I'm talking about. Okay, so you've had that experience of cold winters then, living on the South Island.
Well, yeah, interestingly enough, it wasn't that cold. It's just that the house was designed to insulate the cold rather than heat. So it was on average 5 degrees colder inside in a Scottish-built home in Dunedin, in New Zealand.
Oh, okay. Did you have snowfall?
Yeah, we had snowfall once while we were down there, and the snow was still on the lawn 6 months later because we got about 30 minutes of sunshine in the morning every day, and it didn't manage to defrost that stuff.
Well, now, okay, so where I grew up in Minnesota, it was not unusual to have 4, 5, 6 feet of snow on the ground by March. By the time spring thaw came around. In any case, here's kind of how the analogy that I use. You know, you get a compaction ratio. You start out with a certain footage of snow, and you basically compress it to about half to three-quarters of its density when it's snowfall, and then it's compressed into glacial ice. And you got a picture now that over central Canada, around 15,000 years ago, the glacial ice might have been as much as 2 miles thick. 2 miles thick. I mean, that's where now, of course, it's forests growing. And, you know, moose and black bear and, you know, beaver and lots of wildlife living. And, you know, there are communities and villages and towns. But 15,000 years ago, you had thousands of feet of ice. Well, the onset of a glacial age is apparently not a long, drawn-out, gradual affair. It's something that happens quite abruptly. And it can literally, you can think of it this way. Imagine that you go from summer into autumn, and then from autumn into winter, except that spring doesn't come then for 15,000 years. And that's essentially what the onset of a glacial age is like. And that has happened repeatedly through the history of the Earth, and it's happened multiple times in the last couple of million years. And then, like I mentioned earlier, nobody really has an explanation for that yet.
So you're talking about kind of like seasons within seasons.
Seasons within seasons, or in Ezekiel's terminology, wheels within wheels. Yes, seasons within seasons is a good way of putting it. And so what interested me is that, you know, these were, in a sense, two parallel interests. I spent a lot of time outdoors growing up, a lot of time exploring, hiking, camping, that sort of thing as an adult. I've always enjoyed the outdoors, the natural world. So I've just cultivated an interest in things like geology and astronomy, things like that that, you know, you can't avoid when you're out in the world of nature. And at some point I began to realize that, you know, that this mode of change, this gradualistic mode of change, which geologists refer to as uniformitarianism, that's a mouthful for you. But that's basically the concept that we try to understand all Earth change by reference to things that are going on in the world around us now, and which is a very useful construct for understanding ancient global change. Except the problem comes in when it becomes dogmatic, and then you assume that, well, anything that's happening now, you know, it couldn't have happened any differently in the past. So we attempt to try to fit the explanation for all past global changes into this straitjacket of modern change. Well, the counterpart to gradualism is catastrophism. And catastrophism was the prevailing way of understanding the history of the Earth at the beginning of geology as a science in the early 19th century. And it got supplanted by the gradualistic paradigm, which then became entrenched as dogma by the time we get to the 20th century. So that anybody who started talking catastrophes, well, they must be trying to get us back to biblical fundamentalism and Noah's flood and this sort of thing. And so catastrophe or any discussion of catastrophe fell out of favor for most of the 20th century. The last 2 to 3 decades of the 20th century, though, that began to change dramatically. Primarily, the thing that pushed the pendulum the other way was the discovery that the dinosaurs had probably been exterminated 65 million years ago when a giant asteroid slammed into the Earth moon at, you know, 20 or 30,000 miles an hour, releasing, you know, a couple of 100 million megatons of energy into the Earth's environment and probably triggering a whole host of associated changes, seismic activity and volcanic activity and climate activity and so forth. And that sort of opened the door to discussing catastrophism again as a respectable subject and not just something that was for the crackpots and the fringe element.
Well, it's certainly something for the climate change element, isn't it?
Well, getting into that, you know, I mean, here's the thing you got to understand, Vinny. When a modern environmental movement was born in the late 60s, the gradualistic paradigm reigns supreme. And so when you assume that the history of the Earth has been this long, smooth continuum with very, very few blips in the waveform of change until humans came along with their nasty old industry and capitalism and so forth, you know, the assumption was is that nothing much had really perturbed the serenity of global change until humans came along. But since then, I mean, that paradigm has been completely turned on its head. And the problem is that the environmental movement is still stuck back in the gradualistic paradigm, and they haven't kept up with the changes in thinking that have occurred that really demonstrate now unequivocally that the history of the Earth has been profoundly catastrophic. And some of these episodes of global change have been so far beyond anything that we have yet imposed on the Earth that it's really almost ludicrous. You know, one of the claims that's frequently being made now is that we're in the midst of the sixth great mass extinction. And, let's see, I'm getting
well,
serious.
Well, I think that's actually a good place to leave the first hour. The sixth great mass extinction. I'm going to actually type that one down and bring it up when we come back. You know, what occurs to me is that even if we were going through a sixth great mass extinction, as they're talking about, I think this is the first man-made one, right? Because, you know, you've got, like, all these species dying off everywhere, all our food's contaminated with pesticides, all our water's got fluoride all through it, been chemtrailed every single frickin' day, got Fukushima radiation and Chernobyl stuff all over the place. You know, hey, we're trying to kill ourselves. Or maybe somebody's trying to kill us. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
The virus alert the masses.